Hi, everyone. My name is David Ponnell, a grateful recovered alcoholic. We're on the page that has the paragraph that says, we women carry with us a picture. I'm not sure where that is in the maroon book, because I have a printout in front of me. Anybody want to shout that out for me? 19? 119. Thank you very much.
118.
That's in the blue book. In the brown book is something else, I think.
Yeah, so in the original manuscript.
And what's the chapter?
To wives.
Okay. Two wives in the book is page
118. Third paragraph down.
118, third paragraph down?
No, it's we're in the gray part, page 52. That's where the to the wives is.
Okay, we women carry with us a picture? I'm sorry, if you didn't.
Yeah.
It's page 54 in the maroon book.
Mm-hmm. Right. Page 54 of the original manuscript, guys.
Correct.
Which is 80% of the way through the book.
Right, it's page 118 in the other. Right.
Okay.
All right.
We're all on the same page. We women carry with us a picture of the ideal man, the sort of chap we would like our husbands to be. It is the most natural thing in the world, once his liquor problem is solved, to feel that he will now measure up to that cherished vision. The chances are he will not. For like yourself, he is just beginning his development. Be patient. You know, the funny thing is that this whole idea about, like, what happens to the husband and the wife's view of the husband, you know, I had a reverse situation. My ex-wife is a member, and there was a time after I got sober, I had vision for us, which apparently didn't collide, it wasn't congruent with her vision for us, right? Which is how we became exes. But it's this kind of idea that now that this is over, that somehow this actual thing that happened, you know, the drinking or the pill taking or whatever it was, right, that brought down the spouse, once that's over, that somehow everything will be okay again. And that, you know, and Bill puts it real nice to her. You know, there's a cherished vision that we have. And I have found that I've actually, you know, kind of gotten to a place with my current wife and with all the members of my family where they see me in that role, right? I'm somebody that I've never been before, but I'm not talking myself up. This is not something that I've done. This is something that has happened to me coming in here and doing this work, right? This work is what freed me, not something special that I have. Because I don't have anything special. But the idea that there's this cherished person and that we should show up immediately flies in the face of my alcoholism, right? Because I did not become who I became when I was out there overnight, right? The things it took for me to begin to believe the lie of my existence that allowed me to drink and to do the drugs the way that I did, it wasn't like I was 12 years old and I go, God, life is really awesome. I think I'll become a heroin addict and carry a gun. And, you know, maybe ultimately if I really get to the peak, I'll try to set fire to a police officer, you know. That wasn't what happened. What happened at 12 was, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind having a drink. When my mom has a drink, and she literally has a drink. Like, she has a drink once a week or whatever, however often she has a drink. She has a drink, and she would have a smile on her face, and I saw that, and I didn't have the smile on my face, right? I was a kid who felt, I just didn't feel, I was waiting for the aliens to show up, right? I didn't get the book. Did you get a book? I didn't get a book, right? I did not get a manual on how to live, right? Not until I got the big book. And God, you know, I knew you're not supposed to drink at 12 years old, right? I had some cognitive understanding of, like, what the age limit was, and I was like, well, I'm going to drink. I drank and it solved the problem I didn't know I had, right? And then didn't come across it again for 3 years, couldn't get it, right? And then I knew I still wasn't old enough, but I did it anyway. And then I found ways of doing it more often, right? And all these things kind of fell into place, and slowly but surely everything else had to fall away because of the fact that I'm an alcoholic of my type, right? If you suffer from what I suffer from, you know, it didn't happen overnight. Right. You may have been born that way. I believe I was born that way. I don't think that I was taught how to be an alcoholic. I don't think there was ever a class at Nicholas Murray Butler School 23 in Elizabeth that taught me how to be an alcoholic. I think literally I was born this way. I was predisposed to the to this phenomenon of craving and this feeling of dis-ease that I don't know how to get rid of because I'm not looking for a spiritual awakening. I'm looking for something else. But this consumption that kind of alleviated it for some brief period of time required me to give up a little bit of that person who I really kind of like was at my core. And my wife wanted the cherished person back. She wanted me to show up, the person she knew I was. She wanted me to come back. And she thought that the removal of the alcohol, right, or the return to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would suddenly be that overnight. But I'm not, right? Because those lies don't fit overnight. I don't come into the rooms and go, oh, shit, I need to get God and do some inventory. I'll be right back. Let me write a four-step, you know? And that's not what happens. I fight this stuff tooth and nail. I go, nah, I don't, you know, God, you're going to have me buying condos in Alabama or something. I'm not doing this God thing. You know, it's this whole series of lies that I've been built up. And until I examine the truth of these things, I'm never going to get free. If I'm never free, I'm never going to be comfortable. If I'm never going to be comfortable, I'm never going to be the person that God made because I'm going to be interfering with that person as I roll through the day, right? And I'm going to be creating problems for myself. And those problems become insurmountable, right? And they take all this energy, right? I get in a fight with so-and-so and I do something else and I come home and I'm just looking for some goddamn relief. And then she's asking me about how my day was. How dare you, right? And then I lash out. And I'm not the cherished person, right? Alcoholism hides behind this lie, and it lives in this lie. And I had to learn that from the other side of the other side, right? I had to watch somebody who I love dearly, right, grapple with this truth, right? Grapple with the idea, right, of where the cherished person was, right? Not necessarily with me, although I did watch her grapple with the idea of who I was, but for me also grappling with who she was. And that's why, you know, if you talk to people and you this is the classic case. So when my first wife, we went out on a date, I want to say it was July. We went to the Bronx Zoo. We had a blast. I had known her for over a year in the rooms, but I gave her a year to get her sober before I asked her out, and we had become friends in that period, and when I had asked her out, she thought I was asking her out as a friend, and I'm like, oh shit, she didn't get it, and she was saying to herself, oh shit, I screwed that up, but we actually went out on our first date. We went to the Bronx Zoo, we had a blast. October, we're living together, right? Isn't that, now, if it was Narcotics Anonymous, we would have got an apartment next to the zoo. That's kind of how that works, right? And the truth of the matter is, right, when two alcoholics combine into a sweaty mess like that, the chance, right, is greater for conflict. For the simple, not because we're more broken than the average person, but we can sync up our brokenness, right? So if I'm having a hard day and you're having a hard day, there's going to be a hard day at home, right? We're not going to come home and go, oh, you're having a hard day. Let me put aside my own internal conflict and my belief that the world is really trying to screw me, and let me help you. Right? That's not what happens. We go, well, my day was worse. Right? And that's why alcohol. Both of us were formerly married to alcoholics. Anyway, so and you know, this whole thing is, and when it's good, it's real good, right? It's that, oh my God, this is like the best thing since, you know, whatever your best thing was, sliced bread or whatever. But I don't have that experience with my current wife. She's not an alcoholic, you know. To show you just kind of like not an alcoholic she is, it was very early on in the relationship, but I became upfront with her the very first date, in the very first 15 minutes of the first day. I said, you know, because she's an oniophile. She's a wine connoisseur. She likes to watch shows about, you know, what are they? Sommeliers, and there's a show on Netflix about master sommeliers and how hard it is to get that. You know, and oh, she likes wine. She doesn't drink much of it, right? But she likes it. She likes the whole story behind it. So you know, I told her right from the very get go, if that's that important to you, I'm not your guy, right? Well, this is on the first date in the first 15 minutes. She's like, no, that's not. That doesn't prevent me from you know, having a relationship with somebody. Because it prevents, when I was drinking, that would have prevented me from having a relationship with you. You know, if you're not a drinker, what the fuck is this going to be? Hey, nothing going to work out here. See ya. Save me the cost of dinner. Thank you. And, you know, I know, I mean, it was 3 or 4 weeks later, or, you know, 5 weeks later, we're together one night, and I'm just kind of, we're just talking, we're having that pillow talk stuff, and I said, you ever do cocaine? And she goes, yeah, I did cocaine. And then, like, I'm like, oh, wow, here's something we can actually maybe relate on in the world. I said, well, did you like it? She goes, oh, my God. She goes, I said, well, what happened? She goes, well, I was in a car going to a party, and somebody said, do you want to do a little cocaine? She goes, yeah. She's So I said, well, what happened? She goes, I did a line of cocaine. I was in the back of the car. I said, wow, well, you liked it? She goes, yeah, I loved it. I said, what happened next? She goes, I did a second line of cocaine. I said, my girl. Here's where we parted ways. She goes, I didn't like it as much as the first, so I've never had a second line of cocaine again. Why? I said, The first line is in the bottom of the bag. You've got to go through the bag. Because in the bottom, laying in the very bottom, is that first line of coke. Doesn't matter if it's a quarter pound, you'll get there. But that's the thing, is we don't, you know, so she'll come home, she says to me sometimes, how you doing? I go, I'm fine. And then like 50 minutes later, she'll hear me go, she goes, you're sighing, you're under pressure, what's going on? I go, I'm fine. She's like, Dave, I said, all right, well, I have two finals this week, and I've lost a bunch of money at work, and you know, whatever. Like, you know, it's like all of a sudden, all the stuff that I don't want to talk about is there. But it's not a conflict, right? In the old relationship where we're both alcoholics, right? I could be up and she could be down. She could be up or I could be down. We could both be down, both be up. Right? But the communication was lacking. That cherished person may have existed for moments in the same room with me or me with her, and the other person might not have known it. Right? Because alcoholism keeps me blind to the truth. Alcoholism doesn't allow me the grace and dignity to see anything as it actually is. Right? That's why this entire book and every other book that I've ever read, you know, Chris has pointed me to a bunch of books, and I went on like a journey of reading all this stuff. Everything talks about a spiritual awakening being the abandonment of our old ideas, the letting go of things, the releasing of this idea, whatever it might be, depending on who you're talking to, right? And this particular book is incredibly good about it. Lack of power, that is my dilemma. But the lack of power isn't actually my dilemma, is it? It's my lack of belief that I lack power. Therein lies my problem. I've always lacked power. It's not like, oh shit, I just lost power. Where'd it go? No. Right? My problem is that I believe that I have power. I have lacked power from the moment that I was born. Right? And that's the manifestation of what the lie looks like, right? And it's my fight against all these things. I have to give these things up, these belief systems that I don't actually hold true, in order to be that cherished, be that cherished person for the other person, right? My current wife, excuse me, my current wife has a problem with dishes in the sink. Now, she has a model. Zero things in the sink. I have a model. When you can't get a cup of water from the faucet, time to do the dishes. And she's away for 10 days, so I have... Curtis is laughing.
It's like a muffin.
Thank you. I have actually decided that while she's away, the sink will remain empty. Right. I almost took a picture of a full sink, like made it full, just to send her every day, right? Just to cause her angst, right? Because that's the kind of guy I am, right? But instead, I've just been cleaning the sink, even though she's not there. This is the cherished person that comes out, but it doesn't come out because I want to. And it certainly doesn't come out because I stop drinking. Because that pisses me off, the stop drinking thing, right? But getting a connection to God, doing inventory, getting free, allows me to be present in a state that I've never been before. And I got to tell you something, it's a pretty elegant state. You know, I thought long and hard about the different things that I've gone through in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought long and hard about, you know, my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, people that I know, people that have come and gone, you know, people that have passed, people that I knew in rehab, you know, and it's funny, at my age, I forget half the people that I've ever known, but I've started to really kind of look at what is the gift that I bring to the table when working with a new guy, right? How can I let them know that not only do I suffer from what they suffer from, but that every single part of what has happened to me has not been my doing, and that I actually have fought that evolution the entire time? I have been the only problem in my life. Oh, I still am to this day, right? I fought the idea of God in these rooms for 26 years. Right? It wasn't until doing a big book workshop at my house, and Jill was there, and Mark was there, and for 2 weeks we were going over, We Agnostics, and I literally had an epiphany about I had a God of reason, right? I had a God of reason. If I could figure it out, it was cool, right? And I suddenly realized that faith actually requires me to not figure it out. To actually have not have a faith actually for me, this is my understanding of faith. I don't even need to have a desire to figure it out, right? Just let that go. And it's different than belief for me, right? Belief is for me as I have some knowledge, which is what the second step tells me, right? Came to believe that a power greater source could restore society. I'm only going to do that when a guy like this shows up and goes, let me tell you a little bit about my story. Let me tell you what's happened to me. Right? So I have some evidence. Belief for me is a little bit about evidence, right? Whereas faith is like, is faith only exists with no evidence for me, right? 26 years in, I said, oh, that wasn't a waste of time. Just took longer for me. I'm a slow learner, right? The cherished person in me had to show up only after I started to abandon all these old ideas, after I started to give up this idea that I was ever going to be the person I thought that I should be, and become the person that God made. Right? This thinking that I had as taking on different realms, and you know, have you ever had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous who doesn't treat you right? Right? Somebody who doesn't call you back when you want them to call you back? Right? Who doesn't show you the respect that you deserve as a unemployed alcoholic? Right? I mean, that's a pretty low bar to show some respect, right? As an electrician who drills through suits. I mean, have you ever had one of those people, right? And it's funny, when I think about it, it goes back to this kind of whole idea that we want to belong, right? I didn't hang out in the Lower East Side because I found it attractive. I hung out because that's where my tribe was, right? That's where the people were that I ran with. Right, I didn't hang out with the mobsters because I thought they had a good set of social mores I wanted to adopt. Right, I hung out with them because that was my tribe at the time. Right, it's who I fit in with. Right, and when I come in here, I want to have that same feeling, and it's such an amazing change. Right, because it allows me to really be who I really am. Right, you guys don't ask anything of me. Right, anything. You don't ask me to get your God. You don't ask me to do anything. Just like, okay, you're always welcome, Dave, to have a cup of coffee and a couple of cookies and, you know, and mumble something from the back row. Yeah. How cool is that? But in that acceptance into this tribe, right, I get the opportunity to actually experience what worked for these guys from the very first day. And I can become that cherished person, somebody who I never thought I could be, no matter how hard I tried. Because when I always saw that person who I liked, that person who was always nice to everybody, that person who always got the friends, the person who I just wanted to hang out with, but I never felt good enough to hang out with, I've suddenly become that person in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? The power of God is so attractive that people actually want to spend time with you. Wants to spend time with me. How crazy is that? I don't even like people. They're annoying. I have a dog I like, but people are just awkward. On that note,
Dave doesn't like people. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Chris.
Yeah, you know, I, uh, I, I married an alcoholic. I was about 2 years sober, 3 years sober, and prior to some really serious step work, and you know, that particular one didn't really go too well. Another, you know, the two things in this chapter that I like a lot. One of them is where it says that the wives are supposed to be patient, and the other is the part where it says the wives are not supposed to nag. Those are two of my favorite parts. Another feeling we are very likely to entertain is one of resentment that love and loyalty could not cure our husband or alcoholism. Yeah, that's a funny thing. Like, you know, you can be a spouse, and you can be doing everything there is. You can be arranging everything that there is to be arranged, taking your alcoholic to the best treatment centers and the best therapists, and they show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they start working with a plumber named Larry, and all of a sudden they start to show real progress. It can be an issue, and I think I said a little bit last week about one of the things that can happen is there can be pressure, whether it's conscious or unconscious, from the wife or the husband, for them to, you know, could you back off of those meetings, you know, and be home once in a while. And you know, it's like you spend more time with those AAs than you spend with me, and that kind of an attitude can really be bad. Now there comes a time when we have to start really showing up in our family. There's no doubt about that. We need to be practicing the principles of the recovery program at home. There's no doubt about that. But if an individual hasn't gone through the steps yet and they're going to meetings, there's a good chance, if they are an alcoholic, there's a good chance they're just hanging on by a thread. And you can really mess somebody up by putting a lot of pressure on them to, like, be home more or whatever. So so when I'm working with somebody new, you know, I'm paying attention to how consistent are you with your meetings. You know, I can let you back off of that when you've gone through the steps, when you've made your amends, when you've got a prayer and meditation discipline, when you're working with other people. I'm not so concerned about how many meetings you're making at that point, but prior to that point, you better be consistent with meetings. It says here that we do not like the thought that the contents of a book or the work of another alcoholic has accomplished in a few weeks that for which we have struggled for years. And that's absolutely true. There's things that are conducive to someone's recovery and there's things that aren't. And you're not going to know what they are. You're just not going to know what they are. So they're basically saying in here that the book is very, very important. The working with another alcoholic is very important. And it's going to accomplish what you're probably not going to accomplish. This guy, Bill Borchard, he's the individual who wrote the book, who wrote the screenplay, My Name is Bill W. We all remember that. It was about 30 years ago now with James Woods and James Garner. He also did the movie that was only about 5 years ago. It was called Love Is Not Enough, and it was really the story of Lois Wilson. And Al-Anon, love is not enough. It's not enough for alcoholism. A plumber named Larry can swing in, and that'll be enough. It's crazy, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. But you know, they're kind of warning the spouse in this chapter that this can happen. At such moments, we forget that alcoholism is an illness over which we could not possibly have had any power. Your husband will be the first to say it was your devotion and care which brought him to the point where he could have a spiritual experience. Without you, he would have gone to pieces long ago. When resentful thoughts come, pause and count your blessings. After all, your family is reunited, alcohol is no longer a problem, and you and your husband are working together toward an undreamed of future. Those are some pretty good promises. Still another difficulty is that you may become jealous of the attention he bestows on other people. Honey, there's a woman on the phone named Bunny who wants to go to the gratitude meeting with you. You know, what the hell's going on here? You know, absolutely. We've got to use tact and we've got to use common sense. The woman that I met and married in Alcoholics Anonymous became incredibly jealous of Alcoholics Anonymous and my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if she would have had her way, I would have stayed home every night. That's the way she would have loved it to be. And there was a lot of fight and a lot of turmoil about, I'm the type of alcoholic, I got to stay right in the middle of this thing, folks. I got to be really busy with all this stuff. She was not the type of alcoholic that needed to be busy all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, I think she came into Alcoholics Anonymous to find a husband, if you want to ask me the truth. Now here I am. I know deep down within that I got to be busy with this stuff. And she hadn't gone down the scale as far as I know. There's something that you have to understand with alcoholism. I used to hear stuff like, well, you know, alcoholism is like pregnancy. You're not a little bit alcoholic, you know. It's you aren't. It's binary. That's not even close to true. Alcoholism is progressive. And people can come in here and have not lost power, choice, and control, not do the steps, not be consistent with meetings, and turn this thing into a group therapy, and they can be fine for years, okay? Those are people who have not gone down the scale very far. And then there are people who are what this book describes as the real alcoholic. They're the real deal, folks. And you know what? They've got to come in here. They got to come all the way in. They got to sit all the way down. If they don't do a fourth and a fifth step, they drink. If they don't do their amends, they drink. If they're not praying and meditating on a daily basis, they drink. And if they're not working with other people, they drink. And those are people who have gone down the scale a lot further than other people. Now, a lot of people show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would say the majority of them do not have to do this step work with the intensity that some people have to do it at. Some are sicker than others. And I show up in this marriage, and I'm the type of alcoholic who I've got to have 10 sponsees. I've got to go through the steps every year. I've got to take commitments. I have to have service commitments. I've got to be consistent with meetings. I've got to do all this stuff. And she's looking at me like I'm some kind of fanatic. You know, I'm some kind of AA fanatic. And I hate all these people. And that was a main reason why this marriage didn't work. I would rather be alive than married. And that was the choice that I had to make toward the end of this thing. How do you understand something you can't understand? How do you know something that you just don't know? And she never had experience with the type of powerlessness that I've had experience with. She was not the type of alcoholic I was, so she didn't believe it existed. She didn't think that you had to do all these steps. She didn't think that you had to sponsor all these people, and she didn't think that you had to go to 7 meetings a week. She wasn't the type of alcoholic I was. It was not part of her experience, so she didn't believe it was true for me. This chapter is explaining that your spouse is a very sick person. They're going to need to do a lot of AA work. Back the hell off. You know, I mean, it says that in this chapter. There we go. You may You have been starving for his companionship, yet he spends long hours helping other men and their families. And that was true in this particular marriage. The phone was always ringing. There was always problems. There was always people to talk to. There was always 12-step calls to go on. There's always people that I needed to see at meetings. There was always Saturdays and Sundays where I had to schedule time to meet with my sponsees. And all of this caused problems in my family. You feel he should now be yours, and that's the way she felt. The fact is that he must work with other people to maintain his own sobriety. Sometimes he will be so interested that he becomes really neglectful. And I have to admit that I was. Your house is filled with strangers. They were. You may not like some of them. She didn't like any of them. He gets stirred up about their troubles, but not at all about yours. I did not see her troubles as life or death. It will do no good if you point that out and urge more attention for yourself, which is what she did. It is a real mistake if you dampen his enthusiasm for alcoholic work, which is what she tried to do. You should join him in his efforts as much as you possibly can. And she really did try to do that. She just didn't like it. Direct some of your thoughts to the wives of his new alcoholic friends. They need counsel and love of a woman who has gone through what you have. And again, there were years where she really did try to do that, but her heart was never in it. It is probably true that you and your husband have been living too much alone, for drinking almost isolated many of us. If you're alcoholic, alcoholism is progressive. Over any considerable period of time, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. I will say over any considerable time, your life is going to get smaller. It's not going to get larger. There's going to be fewer and fewer people in it as the years go by. You're going to start to treat your loneliness with isolation, which is something that we do, which is completely insane, but that's what we do. It got to the point with me where I had a bottle of whiskey and I unplugged the phone and don't come knocking on my door, leave me alone. You know, when I drink by myself, I like to be alone, Dave. Mm. You know, and that's the way it was because when I drank with people, there was problems. You know, they would say something, you know, and I'd have to react or I'd say something to them or I'd park on their, you know, rose bushes or, you know, I'd start their couch on fire or, you know, some crazy thing. I mean, you know, it was nuts. Therefore, you need fresh interests and a great cause to live for as much as your husband. If you cooperate rather than complain, you will find that his excess enthusiasm will tone down. Both of you will awaken to a new sense of responsibility for others. You, as well as your husband, must think of what you can put into life instead of how much you can take out. Inevitably, your lives will be fuller for doing so. You will lose the old life to find one much better. And I have. My life is incredible today because of all the stuff that I've packed into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll speak to my ex-wife's existence right now, and she is very, very isolated. She's living above a garage somewhere, and you just don't hear from her. She's involved in her artwork, and she's got a few clients and a few colleagues and her family, and you know that's enough for her. She's got a very, very tight life. I need a big one. And I have an enormous life right now, and it's basically because of this Alcoholics Anonymous stuff. Perhaps your husband will make a fair start on the new basis, but just as things are going beautifully, he dismays you coming home drunk. If you are satisfied he really wants to get over drinking, you need not be alarmed. Though it is infinitely better he have no relapse at all, as has been true with many of our men, it is by no means a bad thing in some cases. You know where relapse can actually be a positive thing? where it convinces you of step one. I now know what powerlessness is. You know, I now know that I can't just not want to drink and have that mean anything. And that relapse will sometimes push you into redoubling your efforts. Okay, if you were going to 6 meetings a week before you relapsed, you're supposed to redouble your efforts. What does that mean? It means you're supposed to go to 12 now. If you weren't, you know, really paying attention to the step work, you need to pay attention to the step work now. If you only did half of your amends before you got drunk, when you come back, you got to finish your amends. You know, you got to redouble your efforts. And if a relapse causes you to make that commitment and follow through with that commitment, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it's inevitable. If you haven't been putting enough work into Alcoholics Anonymous to get enough power back from the process of Alcoholics Anonymous to stay separated from alcohol, then you know you're gonna find that out. And what you can do to keep it from happening again is you need to carve out the time in your life. You need to make sure that there's nothing more important than your recovery work. Your job can't be more important. Your family can't be more important. You know, your recovery has to be more important if you're a relapser. If he adopts this view, the slip will help him. You need not remind him of his spiritual deficiency. He will know of it. Cheer him up and ask him how you can be still more helpful. Even your hatred must go. The slightest sign of fear or intolerance will lessen your husband's chance of recovery. How about putting that on you? You know, how about that? That's pretty tough. The slightest sign of fear or intolerance may cause your husband or your wife to drink. It's not good news. In a weak moment, he may take your dislike of his high-stepping friends as one of those insanely trivial excuses to drink. Never, never try to arrange his life so as to shield him from temptation. The slightest disposition on your part to guide his appointments or his affairs so he will not be tempted will be noticed. Make him feel absolutely free to come and go as he likes. This is important. Remember, Bill is writing this. You know? Make sure he feels that he can come and go as he completely pleases. You know?
And give him $5.
Highlight that part of the book. You know? This is important. If he gets drunk, don't blame yourself. God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. That's a great line. You know why we drink, folks? God has either removed our liquor problem or God hasn't. What can we do about that? We can get involved in this recovery process. Because the recovery process unblocks us from the power of God. That's really what it does. That we're moving the things away that are blocking off the sunlight of the Spirit. So our step work is our responsibility. Our meeting attendance is our responsibility. Our service commitments are our responsibility. But it's God that's going to remove your obsession to drink alcohol. It's much too big of a problem for you. Think back how many times you said, I'm going to get this alcohol thing under control. You know, I'm going to drink like a gentleman next time, or I'm going to moderate, or, you know, I'm giving it up entirely for Lent. You know, and post-Lent, you know, you're drunk as a goat. It's a bigger problem than we can handle on our own. So God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. If not, it had better be found out right away. Then you and your husband can get right down to fundamentals. If a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem along with everything else in God's hands. We realize we've given you much direction and advice. We may have seemed preaching. If that is so, we are sorry. For we ourselves don't care for people who preach. But what we have related is based upon experience, some of it painful. I want to talk just a minute on experience. One of the things I was really confused about when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was the difference between opinion and the difference between experience. And I went to a lot of discussion meetings. And man, you want to hear opinions, go to discussion meetings. You want to hear experience, you get a lot of that in big book meetings. But I just didn't know the difference. And then I got a hold of some really, really good teachers. Now, some of my teachers have given examples. I'll give you an example right now, the difference between knowledge or opinion and experience. There's these two twins. They're 15 years old, and by the time they're 15 years old, they are obsessed with mountain climbing. All they do is they read about mountain climbing, and they watch the TV shows about mountain climbing and YouTube videos about mountain climbing. Now, they're 20 years old, and one of them is going off to college, and he's taking courses on mountain climbing, and he's going to the mountain climbing stores, and he's hanging out there, and he's bought himself all these ropes and all these boots and everything, right? And he's like into this mountain climbing thing. And then the other brother decides he's going to get involved with some people who actually climb mountains. And he ended up at 20 years old being one of the youngest people ever to summit Mount Everest. I mean, he went there and he paid his dues and he learned how to actually mountain climb, and he went up and he experienced what it's like to be on top of Mount Everest. Now, both of these people can give good share on mountain climbing. You know, both of them can really talk about mountain climbing. But who do you think you should really be talking to if you want to understand the experience of summiting some of these mountains? You're going to want to talk to the person who actually climbed a mountain and not somebody who read about it and got a degree about it and has all the equipment. So the same thing is true in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can hear people sharing about spirituality, and you can hear them sharing about being sober and sharing about gratitude and sharing about how wonderful things are. And two groups of people can give that same share. You know, one group will be people who've actually had a spiritual awakening based on the 12 steps. And the other group of people will be people who've just gone to a lot of meetings and have learned how to give good share. Who do you want as a sponsor if you're a real alcoholic? You're going to want somebody who actually has paid the money back and actually done the amends. Somebody who actually prays and meditates. Somebody who knows how to take somebody through the steps because they've been through the steps together. Both types of people sound good in meetings. You know, so that's what I've learned through some of my teachers about experience. We had to learn these things the hard way. That is why we are anxious that you understand that you avoid these unnecessary difficulties. So to you out there who may soon be with us, we say good luck and God bless you. What do you got, Dave?
So, the funny thing is that if you think about Dr. Bob, our co-founder, when he was dying of cancer they said, listen, Bob, you've got to speak at the first international convention. And he got up and he spoke for about 3.5 minutes. And you can find this online, this talk, right? And this talk looks like, a guy who, he's tired. He died within about 6 months. He wasn't really up for the job, but he knew he had to give a talk. Because they were looking to adopt the traditions, right? And he was the guy with the second longest sobriety, right? And as he nears the end of this talk, he starts to talk about, when boiled down to the last, Alcoholics Anonymous is all about love, and we all know what love is, and it's all about service, and we all know about what service is, right? And the thing that really kind of, the experience I had with this chapter in this workshop with Chris this time going through it was, it was a kind of a new view into me, into how to present to the spouse or somebody who's drinking, but also how I've been interacting with my new wife, right? But also in the way that it kind of aligns itself with how do I act in Alcoholics Anonymous? How do I act towards a newcomer or the person I've known since I've come back or from before I came back, right? And the truth of the matter is that I've started through no action of my own, right? Through no effort of my own, right? I have started to put my wife's wants in front of my needs, right? Now, I first heard about that. In 2004, I was down the shore at a meeting, and there was this guy who was sitting two people away from me at this Saturday afternoon meeting, a noontime meeting, wearing, you know, a biker's vest and the chains, and really looked like a rough character, right? And he said that about, that's what it meant to be awake in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I put the newcomer's, you know, wants in front of my needs. And I thought about it at the time. I thought, my God, that's right. Right? The idea that I'm going to treat other people well, right? Even though it seems to conflict, right? With who I am. And I started to do that with my ex-wife, right? But I also started to do that with my current wife, right? And I started to realize that this is how I've been treated most of my life. And I didn't even know it. That people were saying, "Oh, do you need something, Dave? Let me go out of my way to see if you get that for you." Until they became tired of finding it was a one-way street, right? Well, when I turned it into a two-way street, right? All of a sudden, I had a far richer experience, right? And that is a reflection upon how I've been treated in Alcoholics Anonymous. People have taken the time, right, to speak to me when I was a complete fool, right? Which was the truth up until last week. I've been a complete fool up until last week. This week I'm fine, right? But it's this idea, right, that at every given moment I thought I was in one place, but I wasn't. I was in some other place, right? And yet people put up with me, treated me nice, listened to me talk, and invited me back, right? How do I carry that forward, not just to the woman that I love, to my mom, to my kids, to the newcomer, right? You know, you're doing, when you're meeting somebody for the first time and you want to explain to them what happened to you, right? You want to start throwing down, well, if you don't do it my way, you'll drink. You know? I have the only way, and it requires a lobster, right? A lobster and duct tape. I'll see you at my house. Right? 5 a.m. I mean, the crazy... Well, that's what Chris did with me. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's this idea, right, that I have the only way. But no, what I have is this experience with you guys and with God. And I didn't start having a real experience with you guys until I had an experience with God. Right? And that's what I want to let the wife know. Right? I've given out several big books to wives who have then gone to sat with the husband, you know, in a basement where he looked terrible, or in a den, or in a dining room, or whatever the case might be, and gave him a pitch. And I don't sponsor any of those people today, right? I mean, I'm not talking about the wives, I'm talking about the men, right? I don't sponsor any of those people. Whatever happened, they weren't ready, whatever the case might be. But how do I let the wife know that it's possible? How do I let her know that that individual could absolutely exist, given a little love and patience, continue to be the person that you probably are, right? And wait for them to come around and have the experience that I had. You know, this whole thing for me comes down to being the person that God made in me, right? I'm the only person who gets in the way of that. And I hope that when dealing with my wife and others in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get out of the way and just let what God made shine, as opposed to let what Dave would like to be shine. And I think that's all that I have.
Okay.
Want to open it up?
Yeah.
All right. Let's open up.